You're listening to the Judicial Watch weekly update with Tom Fitton.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. A lot going on this week in Washington, D.C. and all across the land in terms of government corruption. We got breaking news from the federal courts on woke discrimination. The Biden border crisis, believe it or not, is getting worse. Republican leadership, believe it or not, is getting worse. We've got new lawsuits to uncover key details about the border Biden crisis and its consequences. Plus, we have important new developments related to Biden corruption, new effort to uncover the truth about his Senate records in Delaware. You're not going to want to miss this. Plus, does a top official at the Justice Department have a Hillary Clinton email problem? I'll talk about that as well. It's just really incredible. First up is the breaking news that the House of Representatives, and I normally don't cover spending issues like this, but it's important, has passed a $1.2 trillion bill that will fund the government completely with the last bill they've passed. So in total, the government will be funded completely through the end of September. And the bill that was passed today included funding for the Department of Homeland Security, the Defense Department, I think the State Department, I think 70% of the agency or federal funding, more or less. And it was a 1,000-page bill. It was released just a minute ago, practically speaking, meaning that no members had any serious opportunity to review it. And it was passed as a result of a minority of Republicans working with virtually every Democrat. I think we have the final vote tally here. Do we have it from C-SPAN? And here we are. So you can see the blues are Democrats voted with a minority of Republicans to pass it over the majority of Republicans voting with a small number of Democrats. It fully funds the Biden border invasion. It supports abortion, transgender extremism, DEI. Now, of course, there have been some policy changes, some increased changes in terms of extra beds at the border, woefully insufficient. Extra Border Patrol agents, woefully insufficient, especially if their job is to let them in. And it's been a significant blowback. I've been talking about this for months. I talked about it at C-SPAN as to I can't understand why a Republican-controlled House would voluntarily fund the destruction of America. Let's go to that C-SPAN clip.
It's hard to imagine why a Republican-controlled House of Representatives would authorize one more dime in taxpayer money for the DOJ-FBI machine. In fact, it's hard to imagine why any House Republican would keep on funding the border invasion, the abuse of Trump, the censorship of Americans, the killing of the unborn, the transgender extremist abuse of our children, and the crazed critical race theory, DEI, in the Biden administration, especially in our military. Defund it all! I don't know about you, but a government shutdown would be well worth it if it means the end of Biden's border invasion.
Yeah, well, a crowd like that. And unfortunately, Speaker Johnson has done the wrong thing. I think he's made wrong decisions in this regard. I don't understand, especially given all of the news this week about what went on at Texas with a violent incursion. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I don't see a distinction between Speaker Johnson on these spending issues and Speaker McCarthy. And I hate to say this, but it's things haven't changed at all in many respects. I was at a press conference with some conservative House Republicans several months ago during the Speaker. Speaker McCarthy administration, when he was running the House, you know, raising concerns about then a continuing resolution. It's the same principle, you know, basically more government money to fund the worst of what Biden is doing. And this is what I had to say.
I'm Tom Fitton. I'm president of Judicial Watch, America's leading government watchdog organization. We have a simple request for Congress. Do your job. It's not enough to do investigations and reports. We need to stop the government corruption and abuse that is so concerning to the American people. In this new budget fight, or basically the old budget fight that we're being asked to pretend is new, there's an inflection point. Are we going to continue to fund Republicans in the House the wild abuse by the Biden administration of its political opponents, the mass censorship of tens of millions of Americans, the border invasion we've heard so much about, and the other wild abuses of power that are right now fully funded with Congress? And I don't know what we're talking about with a clean CR. I see a dirty CR, a CR that will fund the worst, the dirty politics and corruption in our federal government. And there's a positive moral obligation right now, not next year, but right now, to stop the abuses, the effort to jail Trump on pretextual, unprecedented charges in a way never seen before in American history. An obligation to stop right now the Biden administration's censorship of tens of millions of Americans. The obligation to stop right now the illicit use of tax monies to fund abortions in our military and elsewhere. We need to stop right now the attack on children through the promotion of transgender extremism. We need to stop right now the lack of serious investigation into the Biden administration corruption, specifically Biden corruption. We need a Justice Department or a special counsel that has confidence of the American people. All of these issues can be addressed in this continuing resolution. And if they don't want to address it, that suggests to me those who vote for it are on the side of corruption, and those who oppose it are on the side of justice. Thank you very much.
I agree with me. And things haven't changed. I mean, it's just kind of the same argument, different bill. Since then, they did vote to fund all of that. I think three or four times. Republican-controlled House, even under Speaker Johnson. And in my view, it's inexcusable. Now, it goes to the Senate this weekend. It may be passing as I speak. I don't know. So it's never too late to call. And, of course, these fights will come up again even before September 30th in the context of other legislation that's passed, because there are always ways to kind of make these issues something that the members in the House or the Senate have to vote on, whether it be closing off the border, protecting our kids, you name it. And so I think you should continue and right now call your members of Congress, even if it's passed. Call your members of Congress. Share your views about what they should do in the future and how you think they did in the past. Now, Speaker Johnson facing a big fight, and I think highly of Speaker Johnson personally in the sense that he's a great conservative. He comes from the conservative movement. He used to work, many of you may not know this, for Alliance Defending Freedom. I don't think it was called then, but back then, but it was ADF was a famous one of our a group I greatly admire that does great First Amendment work on behalf of Christians. And Mike was a great lawyer who worked for them, and so a conservative movement lawyer who's now Speaker of the House. So in many ways, it's extraordinary. But on the other hand, it's disappointing that he's kind of made these choices. Not to stand and fight on at least one key issue. As I said in my speech at CPAC that you saw, I mean, maybe just pick something to fight over. Say, you know what? We've got this fight coming up in the next few months about whether to fund DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, or other agencies. And I just can't imagine being able to vote for that if it means involved, if it means including money to help aliens invade the United States of America. And so even though I know all the conservatives on the Hill like Mike Johnson, he's now losing support, and who knows, maybe there'll be another speaker. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the conservative congresswoman, is filed a motion just as we speak almost to vacate the chair. I think we have it's a pretty simple motion. I don't know if you can read it at the bottom there. I can't read it at the bottom. I got to walk closer to the screen. Resolved that the office of Speaker of the House of Representatives is hereby declared to be vacant. Now, I'm not quite sure what the what the process is going to be from here, whether it will be considered or when it will be considered. But the point being, conservatives are very upset about the way things are going on Capitol Hill, especially given the crisis. And Marjorie Taylor Greene talked to our friends over at One America News about this, and we have a clip of her remarks.
Mike Johnson brought part two of an omnibus to the bill to the House floor this morning and forced all of us to vote on a bill that would fund abortion up until full term, that doesn't do anything to secure our border. This is not what Republicans support. We don't want to vote for a bill that funds those type of things that are against our values in order to fund our military. That shouldn't be the choice that Republicans were put in. However, that's what Speaker Johnson did to our entire conference today. I put in the motion to vacate respectfully. This is not a personal attack against Mike Johnson at all. I respect him completely.
Yeah, you know, when you're talking about who should be a leader, it's not necessarily like, in my view, I may be naive in talking about it this way, it's not the person, right? That's how I kind of approach these issues. You know, reporters will sometimes ask me in Judicial Watch, you know, who should so-and-so pick to be X? And I don't know. But my view is, what should be the approach or what you should look for in who you pick to be a leader or to advance your goals if they're an official in an administration? And the approach should be, in my view, taking leadership on these core issues, recognizing the threat to our republic caused by this invasion, caused by the abuses of Trump, caused by the abuses of our children, the censorship of Americans, and say, there's something there that I'm never going to fund and I'm willing to shut the government down over unless it's stopped. And let the chips fall where they may, because our country is at risk. That's what we need from the speaker. And maybe Speaker Johnson will get his head together in that regard and provide leadership there. But one of the reasons he's facing challenges from folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene and other members of the House Freedom Caucus is because of his failure to take those leadership steps, however good he is on these other issues. And this crisis isn't going away. Let's look to see I hope you've seen the video of what went on in Texas this week. I mean, this is absolute insanity, chaos caused by the invasion, aided and abetted, of these United States by the President of the United States, Joe Biden. And look at these poor folks, law enforcement personnel in Texas, facing this violent, violent invasion. And the response from the Republican-controlled House is to fund the policies that lead to this. Look at that. Now, it's been reported since this video has come out that all of our folks who assaulted our personnel, our American citizen personnel there, were processed by the Biden administration. And I tell you, if they go to certain cities, if they go here to Washington, D.C., for instance, they'll be able to vote, maybe even run for mayor. The left wants them to be able to vote. Indeed, they can vote in many local elections across the country. Fully funded by the Republican-controlled House. And then, of course, we have the abuses of Trump that continue, fully funded by the Republican-controlled House. They're trying to jail and destroy this man. I hope you've been tracking what's going on up in New York with Letitia James trying to enforce his civil judgment against Trump that had no basis in fact or in law, in my view, that on its face is confiscatory, an abuse of process, a violation of the Constitution. Excessive fines, isn't that the language in the Constitution? Upwards of $655 million. And in order to appeal that type of ruling, Trump, typically, what happens is generally, if you have an adverse civil judgment against you in court, you get a judgment for a certain amount of money, and you appeal it, you got to put up a bond. either the entire amount, or you can seek waiver or leave from the court. This is my non-lawyer understanding of the process. But the court can give you a kind of a pass, either a percentage or you know, some other modification, or completely waive it at all. But up in New York, the courts thus far have required Trump to put up the full amount plus. And Trump went to the court and disclosed to the court that he's tried to get a bond to cover the 400 plus million number plus interest. Who knows what the number is actually. And he can't get it. He's talked to everybody and their mother. In fact, I was reading in the New York Times, effectively, he would have to pony up $1 billion in cash just to get the bond. Because those numbers aren't, it tells you something, that a number like that is completely alien to companies, insurance companies and such, who normally engage in this type of business, providing bonds for people who need to pony up money in order to assure a court or another party that they're good for it if a dispute goes one way or the other. And there's been nothing like this in American history. The seizure, the attempt to seize and destroy the business of a presidential candidate like Trump. Well, we've seen it in Putin's Russia. We've seen it in China, but never in America. And I tell you, if the New York courts and the federal courts don't step in to protect Trump in this regard, it will be an utter failure for our judiciary in terms of its ability to protect us from the abuses of an out-of-control government. Fully funded. So, you know, you would think maybe a Republican on the Hill or a conservative or even a principal Democrat will say, boy, New York is abusing the civil rights of Trump. Maybe we should, you know, not fully fund what they're able, in terms of monies they get that we have discretion over, like grants and things like that. Nope, none of that's been done. None of that's been done for Fannie Willis. Alvin Bragg, we've talked about, he's another anti-Trump fanatic who's abusing his power to try to jail Trump. Jack Smith, fully funded. Unacceptable. And the same Justice Department makes a mockery of the rule of law in targeting Trump while protecting Biden. And I guess that's the other big news this week. I have to track all the news because it's completely insane that Tony Bobulinski, the president's former business partner, Joe Biden's former business partner. He won't admit it, but he was. He worked with Hunter and Joe and their other business associates. He testified to Congress. And in his testimony, which was blockbuster, he confirmed or alleged quite dramatically and with credibility that Hunter Biden and Jim Biden, Joe Biden's brother, lied to Congress repeatedly about what they were doing with Joe Biden in terms of foreign monies from abroad, etc. And Bobulinski had some dramatic testimony in this regard about how the Chinese have compromised the president of the United States.
My biggest appeal to everyone in this room is I wish you would spend the time focusing on the fact that the Chinese Communist Party infiltrated the White House of the United States of America through the Biden family. I don't say that lightly. It's not a joke. I was willing to die for this country, as was my father and both my grandfathers and my brother. This is serious, serious stuff. We should be asking how that happened. Take the Biden name and the Biden family completely out of it. How did the Chinese Communist Party infiltrate the White House of the United States of America? Let's start there, focus on those facts, what they did, how they did it, why they used money, why they used private enterprises instead of military stuff and other stuff. That is huge to our national security.
Important point by Tony Bobulinski. By the way, a veteran who's been maligned and smeared by the Biden regime and their apologists. He had to suffer through this crazed questioning by the infamous progressive Democrat, who's essentially a Marxist, defending the worst type of cronyism and political corruption involving foreign corporations. I just love how these progressives give Biden a pass on the worst type of crony capitalist corruption. And I posted something on Instagram where I was watching it and reacting. Here it is, AOC's infamous questioning.
Is it your testimony today that you personally witnessed President Joe Biden commit a crime?
I believe the fact that he was sitting with me while I was putting together a business
deal. Did you
deal,
witness the president commit a crime? Is it your testimony today?
Yes.
And what crime do you have you witnessed?
How much time do I have to go through it?
It is simple. You name the crime. Did you watch him steal something?
Corruption statutes, RICO and conspiracy.
What is it? What is the crime, sir? RICO is not a crime. It is a category. What is the crime?
It's a category of crimes that you're then charged
with. You have charges.
A long hundred.
You have charges. Sir, please
want me to name the exact statute under RICO?
Yes.
Well, it's funny. In this committee room, everyone's not here. There's over 18
all right, sir, I reclaim my
lawyers
time.
That went to law school.
Time.
I'll leave it
my
up
time.
To you guys
okay,
to
thank
define
you,
the
sir,
statute
I reclaim my time.
RICO.
Clearly, what we are seeing here today is a continuation of the 15-month saga of the Republican majority lost in the desert.
So, RICO is a crime. It's a federal law. Now, there are components of that crime, but it's a crime. You prove it by showing other violations of law. And of course, even if she's technically right, it's what did I say on Twitter about it? Dishonest sophistry, right? Is that the way to put it? But that's the most sophisticated argument you have, frankly, AOC is promoting against these issues related to Joe Biden's corruption. And so my question is, when is he going to get impeached? We've seen this impeachment issue pop up now. We're in nearly April. It is an election coming up. And I've kind of pushed for answers on this, and you know, they don't know when they're going to impeach him, or even if they'll impeach him at all, because there are some fearful Republicans who don't want to address this issue forthrightly, despite this dramatic evidence of criminal activity by Joe Biden. And you know, in the meantime, you have this unprecedented jailing of former, I shouldn't say unprecedented because you know, I go back to the Nixon years, but of former senior White House officials who were involved in a good faith dispute with Congress about whether they could testify or not, and specifically Peter Navarro. And I posted up something else on social media the other day where I was watching him. And pray for Peter Navarro because he's a political prisoner. He's going to jail because he was found guilty by a D.C. jury, prosecuted by the Biden regime, for failing to abide by a subpoena from the Pelosi witch hunt operation in Congress. And here's what he had to say just before he went to jail.
And charges will be on anybody who is in there, it's harder on their families. And this is who those Democrats have hurt. This is who the Democrats have hurt. I will walk proudly in there, do my time. What they do to people. And by the way, fact check this. I will be the only person in that prison who's been convicted of a misdemeanor. Everybody else is in there, felony. I will gather strength from this. Donald John Trump is the nominee for the Republican presidential campaign.
So he's going to go to jail for 4 months. He's in prison for 4 months at least. Maybe he'll get some time off for good behavior. I don't know how it will work for him technically in that regard. But pray for Peter Navarro. I consider him to be a political prisoner. Now the left goes ballistic when I say things like this and when folks who share our views talk like that. But it's true because I don't believe this process was fair, nor was it pursued for anything other than political reasons. Now, Bannon's also facing charges. He's been convicted already. Steve Bannon, the former Trump aide at the White House, a friend of Judicial Watch's, he's facing jail time if an appellate court doesn't rule in his favor. An anti-Trump appellate court here in Washington, D.C. So things are in an awful state here in Washington. And, you know, the symptoms of that are obviously up in New York as well, because it's all part of the contagion, right? The abuse of Trump and people around him. And it's terrible to see what's happening to him in New York and here in Washington, D.C. and down in Florida and Fulton County. But it's dangerous for the country. It undermines our credibility abroad. And in the meantime, there's always the other side of it, which is that it's almost always designed not only to go after Trump and people like Peter Navarro and people who are publicly strong in behalf of Trump and the punishments of him in terms of opposing them. It's also about protecting Biden, as Bob Alinsky shows. And someone like him gets viciously attacked by this far-left congressman in New York arguing over RICO? Yeah, Joe Biden, there is strong evidence of a racketeering operation run by Joe Biden, the president of the United States. And he's lied about it repeatedly. He's benefited from it, both directly and indirectly. And his family's involved in it as well. So it's the D.C. Mafia, or its version of it here in Washington, D.C., the Mafia. It's a terrible situation we're in, especially since the monies he's taken have compromised him both from Russia and China and Lord knows where else. And Judicial Watch will continue its separate investigations on all these issues, and I'll talk about them here. But we have to demand, as citizens, that the United States government and our courts and Congress and law enforcement do their job. And it isn't happening. In fact, they've been hijacked by politicians who are trying to jail their political opponents, turning us into a banana republic. So I'll talk more about that in a few minutes, but I do want to give you some good news. So a few weeks ago, we had filed a complaint with the Judicial Council that's out of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. So essentially, the federal courts in America are divided into circuits, and the Seventh Circuit includes Illinois. And the chief judge there, the Honorable Diane Sykes, she's the person at the top who handles ethics complaints against other judges in the circuit there. And there were three Illinois judges that had become public, had standing orders that were discriminatory. There were woke standing orders passed probably, I think, around 2020. And we had filed this ethics complaint back in February 2024, so earlier this year. And our friends over at American First Legal Foundation, another group that does a lot of work like Judicial Watch does, they're kind of the newbies to the scene, but they've been around 2 or 3 years now. They were founded after the Trump administration. They do some great work, including this ethics complaint they also filed. They filed it before we did, so I want to give them credit. We filed it afterwards. And, you know, sometimes if another group files something, it's like, well, you know, they did it. We don't need to do it. But the issue is so important, we thought that, you know, there's got to be additional voices out there opposing what happened here. And what had happened was the judges had filed district court judges, federal judges. District court is kind of the first level of judges, and then you have the appellate court judges, and then you go to the Supreme Court. And the district court judges in the Southern District of Illinois, there were three judges we had found or had evidence of, based on reports, had published orders that provide discriminatory benefits to certain people, basically ethnic minorities, racial minorities, and women. Completely inappropriate. And we don't file, as you might imagine, ethics complaints against federal judges lightly. But as I said, this was pretty darn serious. You know, we are all supposed to get equal protection of the law, especially lawyers appearing before a federal court judge. And this is what the order said, more or less, because they're all quite similar. So I'm going to summarize it by reviewing one. Judge Stacey Yandel entered a standing order, and she did this in January of 2020. Recognizing the importance of the development of future generations of practitioners through courtroom opportunities, the undersigned encourages the participation of newer female and minority attorneys in proceedings in my courtroom, particularly with respect to oral argument. To that end, the court adopts the following procedures regarding oral arguments as to pending motions. After a motion is fully briefed, as part of a motion requesting oral argument, a party may alert the court that if oral argument is granted, it intends to have a newer female or minority attorney argue the motion or a portion of the motion. If such a request is made, the court will grant the request for oral argument on the motion grant the request for oral argument on the motion if it is all practical to do so. Strongly consider allocating additional time for oral argument beyond what the court may otherwise have allocated were a newer female or minority attorney not arguing the motion. Permit other more experienced counsel of record the ability to provide some assistance to the newer female or minority attorney who is arguing the motion were appropriate during oral argument. Now, if they had just said, if you're a new lawyer, we'll give you special consideration, maybe that might be appropriate. I don't know why it might not be. But by giving special consideration to minority and female lawyers, I mean, A, you don't have a right to an oral argument. So you may have a question you want the court to decide and you're debating it. You know, obviously you're in civil litigation typically. The court doesn't have to grant you oral argument. They can decide it on their own through, you know, without any papers. Here, it looks like you have a leg up in getting oral argument. And typically you might want to, in my experience, lawyers like to have oral arguments, at least good lawyers do, because you get to make your case again to the court, right? You know, would you rely, if you were trying to get someone to do something, would you just rely on a letter? If you could, in addition to that, go in and talk to them in person? It's easy to understand why oral arguments are sought often by lawyers. But the idea that you get special treatment and special consideration for one, that's not correct. It's not correct under our Constitution, the fair administration of justice. Really disturbing that these three judges had put that in there. And then, of course, you know, if you're a minority or a female lawyer, you're allowed to get special help at the podium for more experienced attorneys to make your argument. I mean, that's not right either. And I'm trying to be nice. I try to be nice, believe it or not. And I understand maybe they were like thinking, well, you know, these folks patronizingly too often the approach is, but maybe it was just an honest mistake, right? They were trying to help folks that they thought typically don't have the experiences that other lawyers get in oral arguments. So they wanted to be sure they had access to those experiences through this equal opportunity. But you got to follow the law and ensure that people understand that there's no racial and gender-based favoritism. And that was not the case here. And that's why we filed the ethics complaint. We said the orders are discriminatory and unconstitutional and can constitute conduct prejudicial to the effective and expeditious administration of the courts. Guess what? We won. And to the credit of the judges, they agreed with us. Now, they didn't say it in as directly as our complaint said it, but in a remarkable decision, it was just released before I got out here. So I kind of had to read through it quickly. Judge Sykes, the chief judge of the district, of the circuit I told you about, said, look, the orders have been rescinded, and they fixed it, and they've authorized me to publicize it. And we're like, well, that's great. I mean, I don't want to put too fine a point on it. I don't know if I printed out the detail I wanted to do on this. Maybe I did. Yeah. So Judge Sykes says that, you know, she noted that we filed the complaint and our friends at American First Legal Foundation filed the complaint. Now, one of the judges said, and she attached letters, and the judges authorized the release of these letters, that I had, that order was old and I had rescinded it and, you know, we should have caught it. Well, of course, we didn't say it was, because we couldn't find it. We were basing our complaint on some published reports. But that judge even acknowledged that there was an issue potentially with the order. And this is the key line. The ruling states, in sum, all three judges have rescinded the standing orders that are the subject of these complaints. They also revised their case management procedures, which now state only that the judges welcome or encourage oral argument by relatively inexperienced attorneys. The judges no longer have a policy of preferential treatment for new or inexperienced attorneys of any other or any other particular group of lawyers. More specifically, the judges have eliminated their prior policies of preferential treatment based on the lawyer's sex, gender, race, or ethnicity. And so that complaint has been dismissed. Now, they were asking us if we're going to sue or appeal this decision. It's like, well, you know, they admitted their mistake, they were public about it, and they fixed it in a timely way once the complaints were made. I mean, why would we, you know, I guess we could always appeal it because we want a more significant punishment. But to me, this is kind of a remarkable story in the sense that we had a series of public officials, and I don't know who appointed these other judges. You know, for all I know, they could be left-wing liberals, right? It doesn't matter to me. They did the right thing here. And I'm going to read you the letters they wrote to the court. The chief judge for that district, so Chief Sykes is the appellate chief. Chief Rosenstengel in the Southern District of Illinois is the chief for the district court level, so the level below. She had the standing order like this, and then this is what she said. I acknowledge I chose the wrong means to accomplish my goal of expanding courtroom opportunities for young lawyers. As worded, the standing order created perceived preferences based on immutable characteristics. As such, my procedures have been revised and the standing order eliminated. And she said, I've never based my decision to grant or deny oral argument on an attorney's sex, race, or other immutable trait, nor would I ever do so. And she went on to say that, you know, this is something that would be alien to her, and I appreciate that. And I have to tell you, she didn't have to make this public. Chief Judge Sykes, nor the other judges, they could have just said, well, the orders are done, they're gone. They could have just disappeared, and we wouldn't know what. And then Chief Sykes could have written a letter back, or a public statement, or no statement at all, potentially, saying, oh, we took care of this, and we'd have no real resolution in terms of whether the judges acknowledged there was an issue that we were right to complain about. Now, another judge's order I read to you, Judge, I'm going to get her name right, Stacy Candell, I think it is, or Candle, let me see. Excuse me, Stacy M. Yandel, Yandle. She wrote the following. These are federal court judges making these admissions. Great, great, great model for public service in my regard, in my view. While I've never granted or denied oral argument to an attorney based on their sex or race, nor would I acknowledge that as worded, the procedure in the standing order created a perception of preference based on immutable characteristics. As a result, I've eliminated the standing order. Good for her. Chief Dugan, Judge Dugan, the other judge who we complained about. First he says, look, I removed this 2 or 3 years ago, back in 2022. But even though he technically didn't have this order still as part of his operations in the court, this is what he said. I can assure you, the court, the counsel, Mr. Hamilton, and he was part of American First Legal. He had, Gene Hamilton filed the complaint. and the public generally that notwithstanding the allegations, I have not on any occasion in my now 7 years on both the state and federal benches granted, denied, or even seriously entertained access to oral arguments specifically or to our court generally on the basis of race, sex, or age, or any other immutable characteristic. Nor will I be in the future. Still, I recognize and acknowledge how such references could cause confusion for someone, and for that I am regretful. Imagine if other politicians took this approach in denouncing and pulling back, or corporations for woke policies. There's no defense here by any of these judges of this order. And to me, it's a remarkable testament to their ethics. And I think this is a big victory for ethics on the judiciary, transparency, and accountability. And I want to credit all three judges. And I know I'm supposed to be cynical, and I'm sure some of you will look at this and say, Tom, you're being entirely too nice. They should have been removed from the bench. And I respect your views in that regard. But having done this for 25 years, this is a remarkable development on a key issue where woke discrimination is encouraged in all sectors of our nation's public life, cultural, corporate, government, educational, right? And here the judiciary said, no, not here. It's the rule of law. We treat everyone equally, no matter your race, no matter your gender. Isn't that what we all want? And here it is, as affirmed. And this is my statement. I don't even think we've issued this yet, so I don't know if it is my statement, but it's my statement at least in draft form. So if I make a mistake, it's in draft. This is a remarkable victory for judicial ethics, accountability, and transparency. The courts did the right thing in acknowledging and correcting their mistakes in a public way. We are hopeful that the quick and decisive result here sends a signal to any other courts to end any woke policies that perpetuate discrimination and undermine confidence in the fair administration of justice. So this is a great victory. It's a credit to Judicial Watch and our supporters for highlighting this and giving us the ability to highlight this. And thank you to my friends at American First Legal Foundation who filed the initial complaint here, and we followed up with our own complaint. And thank you to the judges for doing the right thing here. We need more of it. And when we see someone do the right thing, let's promote it and sing about it from the mountaintops. We got a lot more to talk about. So take a breath. Maybe I need to take a breath. Let's get back to the border, because that's the real crisis of the day, right? I mean, in terms of the destruction of our country, I know we talk a lot about a lot of issues, right, that make us concerned for the future of our country. If we have no border, we have no country. Our country can be over in a heartbeat with no border. We become just a byway and a highway for the mass movement of peoples. And in fact, that's what we have become. And it's a testament to the power of our republic that we still are a country, despite 10, 12 million, who knows what the number is, of aliens coming into the United States at the invitation, specifically enabled by the President of the United States, Joe Biden. Why he isn't being impeached for that, I just can't believe it. We filed a new FOIA lawsuit, and this is kind of like you can't believe they're doing it category of border mendacity by the Biden administration. So we've got the wall, right? You've seen the Trump wall. So part of the engineering of that is there are floodgates in sections of the wall, so they can open the floodgates and close them when necessary. Well, guess what the Biden people did? And this is the New York Post report. Let's post that. They welded it open so people could walk through. So they not only left it open, but they welded them open. So how do you like that for a border wall? And so what Judicial Watch did was, as we're want to do, is that we asked for records about what was going on here. We cited that Washington, that New York Post report, so the government knows what we're talking about. It was an August 2023 report by the New York Post, in which the Border Patrol admits it was responsible for a decision to weld open more than, I didn't realize this, I missed this in the release, 100 floodgates. So it wasn't just two or three. I showed you the photo. Let's bring that photo up again. So it's not just one, two, three, four there. There were 100 of them open like that on the wall. I mean, the cartels don't have any greater friend than the Biden administration. That's for sure. And they didn't give us any documents. I mean, it's a simple request. I mean, how many emails could there be about welding or communications or other records about welding this all up or welding them open? The New York Post story cites Border Patrol data showing the border sector of Tucson, which includes the area with the open floodgates, has become the busiest in the country, with the Border Patrol encountering 42,000 individuals trying to cross legally and illegally into the country back in just 1 month alone in July of 2023. About 1,400 migrants a day from as far away as China and Egypt. Don't get me started about the Chinese illegal aliens crossing. Do you think that's an accident? Do you think they're just showing up as migrants? Oh no, that's a Chinese communist government operation. And this Biden administration's, I mean, China's literally invading the United States through these illegal aliens crossing our border. And Biden isn't doing anything about it. He's opening the floodgates, quite literally opening the floodgates to them. And they're unlawfully hiding on top of everything, right? So I showed you the scandal of them welding the floodgates open. They're unlawfully hiding records about it. And so we're in federal court trying to get basic information about the worst invasion of the United States in American history. Frankly, in world history. Never before have so many human beings moved from one place to another in such a brief period of time. And of course, you know, what are the consequences of this type, this invasion? It's not just economic. It's not just, you know, jobs related. Tax-related, changing the makeup of our government-related, meaning power is apportioned among the states based on population, and a greater illegal population means means more power for that state in Congress and in the presidential elections. But it means people are dying who otherwise would not have died but for the presence of these illegal aliens. People are being raped who otherwise would not have been raped but for the presence of these illegal aliens. And you hear these leftists say, oh, well, illegal aliens don't cause any more crime than regular citizens or even less. Well, that just misses the core point that those crimes would never have existed but for their unlawful presence enabled by the federal government and their allied states and localities that allow illegal aliens to stay here without fear of consequence in terms of the rule of law. And it results repeatedly in people and innocents dying. So yeah, that's why I get mad when Congress keeps on funding this murderous invasion. And that's why we sued on a case that has shocked the nation and caused the president to embarrass himself before the nation, the death of Laken Riley, who was killed by an illegal alien present because of Joe Biden. There's beautiful Miss Riley, dead, killed allegedly by an illegal immigrant. And we sued the University of Georgia. There's the illegal immigrant, Jose Antonio Ibarra. She was assaulted and murdered. He's the guy who they arrested, and he shouldn't have been here. No doubt about it. And now the University of Georgia, where she was killed, is hiding records about this incident, and they're doing it without any lawful basis. I don't know who they're trying to protect or what makes them think the law doesn't apply to them, but we're fighting in court now in Georgia. And we've got a lot of cases in Georgia now, but we've got the Fannie Willis cases that we're suing for, documents, and now University of Georgia. We sued in the Superior Court of Clark County after the police agency, the University of Georgia Police Department, failed to comply with a March 1st and March 14th Georgia Open Records Act request, claiming that the records requested were exempt because they are records of law enforcement and pending investigations or prosecution. Well, the law doesn't allow you, though, to withhold initial incident reports or 911 audios. We had asked for the audio recording of the 911 call reportedly made by Lake and Riley when she was allegedly being assaulted, the initial arrest report, and the initial incident report. We say 911 records are public, and they can be released to the public as long as redactions are made or any names of any names, addresses, or telephone numbers of the person placing the call. Similarly, initial arrest and incident reports are supposed to be public. Well, we know they're prosecuting someone. I mean, these are just like initial preliminary reports, typically public under state law. Why are they being withheld? Riley, a 22-year-old student at Georgia's Augusta University, was killed while jogging in a park on the University of Georgia campus. Her alleged killer is an illegal alien from Venezuela. There are political forces that wish to suppress the truth about what happened to Lake and Riley. But Judicial Watch will insist on transparency under the law for the public interest and the public safety. And of course, this has gotten Joe Biden into trouble because he doesn't seemingly care about the violence he has wrought. Let's go to the videotape of him reacting in excruciating fashion, getting the poor girl's name wrong.
Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals?
Well, I don't even know what he's saying there, beside the point. It's Lake and Riley. Lincoln, I think, is a football coach. There you go. He's okay. Lakin's the one who's dead, Mr. President. And of course, what was the less reaction? He called them illegals. You're not allowed to call illegal aliens illegals, shorthand. Legal aliens, by the way, is a legal term. It's in federal law. Illegals is an easy shorthand. And so rather than apologize for not even knowing the name of this poor girl who's been across the national news, he apologizes to the murderer. Let's go to that tape.
You used the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lake and Riley.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
I mean, talk about like a Marxist struggle session. Denounce yourself for saying something politically incorrect that we've deemed politically incorrect, even though it's been used for decades as a normal term to describe illegal aliens, people unlawfully present, or people who you brought in here who should be unlawfully present. But that's where we are. Poor girl gets murdered. We can't get key information about her murder by, looks like, an illegal alien and the president of the United States, rather than trying to vindicate her right to life. Apologizes to the illegal aliens who are killing Americans and the left that enables them. On MSNBC. So this is why Judicial Watch's work is important, because we don't get distracted by the communist propaganda. Yeah, I said it, communist. You want to destroy the country? You're a communist. You're a leftist. You want to destroy the country through open borders? You're a communist. You don't care about Americans getting murdered by people who shouldn't be here? You're a communist. And Biden's kowtowing to it. Just terrible. Enabling it. The fact he hasn't been impeached is another failure of leadership by the Republican-controlled House, by the way. Yeah, taking money from China, running a racketeering operation is pretty darn bad, but allowing the invasion of the United States, putting lives at risk, getting people killed, isn't that worse? Speaking of Biden, personal corruption, remember the Delaware records? Now, Judicial Watch and our friends at the Daily Caller News Foundation have been alone in trying to get Joe Biden's Senate records that he had been hiding from the American people that were housed at the University of Delaware. And the University of Delaware told us that they couldn't give us the records because they weren't public records. No taxpayer money had been used to collect or maintain them. And the courts agreed. We couldn't even get the secret agreement they had. See, that's how things work in Delaware, it looked like. But then HER issued a report that raised questions about whether the University of Delaware lied to the courts. And we just filed another brief asking for the case to be reopened based on what looks to be a series of lies by the University of Delaware to protect itself and Joe. Now, of course, we know, based on public reports and the HER report, that there was classified records he had for decades he wasn't allowed to have that were part of those records. So we moved to reopen the Senate records lawsuit that we famously had filed because this special counsel report suggested the University of Delaware misled and lied to the courts. Let me get some detail here. In July 2020, Judicial Watch initially filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the University of Delaware for Biden's Senate records, which are housed at the library there. It was filed in state court in Delaware. July 2023, the Delaware Supreme Court sided with the University of Delaware, denying the release of President Joe Biden's Senate records because the university stated to the courts no tax dollars were used to manage the records. On February 5th, 2024, just last month, HER released his report on the Biden records scandal, which called into question the representations by the university that no state tax dollars were used to manage the Biden Senate papers, which HER found to have contained unlawfully retained classified information. So unlike presidential records or vice presidential records, to which I would argue Joe Biden had a right to have even in his home, and that same right applied to Trump, he didn't have any right to classified records from his days as a Senate and should have been convicted or prosecuted. But we're told his memory was bad, right? So I guess I could talk a lot at length about that, but that's beside the point here. This is what we say to the court in asking the court to reopen this litigation. The university's affidavit, they filed an affidavit trying to convince the court, and they did. The no taxpayer monies were used, therefore it's not public. The university's affidavit provides in relevant part that no consideration was paid to President Biden. No consideration was paid to President Biden, state-funded or otherwise, in connection with the senatorial papers. To the contrary, the special counsel report found that Mr. Biden asked two of his former longtime Senate staffers to review his boxes in courtesy storage, and that the staffers were paid by the University of Delaware to perform the pre-gift review. That sounds like consideration. They paid someone to help Joe Biden. Otherwise, Joe would have had to pay for the employees himself. These former staffers reviewed and cataloged the boxes and recommended to him which papers to donate. Again, this is from HER's report. One staffer emailed President Biden, "I have not forgotten about the boxes and files at your house. I am looking to start on those just after Thanksgiving." Another email notes that the staffer was looking through about 20 to 25 boxes in the garage from that group. He had about 2 boxes of Senate material so far. And they told the court we had nothing to do with it. We didn't spend money. They were paying employees to help Joe get the records together for the gift. The search for Senate documents took place at Mr. Biden's direction, required the participation of many, and was paid for by the university. Even the university general counsel was involved in coordinating with Mr. Biden's chief of staff. In sum, the report shows that the president directed his former staffer's work in reviewing and cataloging the Senate papers, receiving the benefit thereof, and the university paid for it. Such payments constitute consideration paid on President Biden's behalf in connection with the donation of senatorial papers to the university, contrary to the representations of the university. Now, before we filed this motion, we asked the lawyers, what's your response here? We asked the University of Delaware's lawyers. And this is what we described to the court as what went on. On February 20th, 2024, petitioners wrote to the counsel for the university seeking clarification and additional information regarding the discrepancies between the special counsel report and the supplemental affidavit. On March 13, 2024, the university responded, dismissing petitioners' concerns and doubling down on the representation that no consideration was paid to Mr. Biden for the gift of his Senate papers, and that your apparent assertion that payment for services provided to the university by former Biden staffers who are independent contractors, what difference does that make? Constitutes a payment of consideration to Mr. Biden for the gift of the Senate papers is simply false. Oh, and that former, when I said formers, that was the emphasis in the original correspondence from the university's lawyer. But, you know, as we tell the court, the lawyer is wrong. It directly contradicts the special counsel report, which found that Biden solicited and directed his former staffer's work. The former staffers performed work for the Mr. Biden rather than the university, and the university paid the former staffers. So they were Biden, you know, it's like saying, I didn't get any consideration from Burisma. I mean, they paid people to come and get my papers together for me. Of course, that's consideration for me. That's something I'd be responsible for otherwise. Now, to be clear, I have no relationship with Burisma. These stunning revelations from the Hur report extend beyond the president's memory lapses and mental state. The court needs to reopen this case to determine whether the University of Delaware lied, says Michael Bastuck, who is the editor-in-chief of our friends at the Daily Caller News Foundation, who's also our co-plaintiff and who we're representing here. The Hur report provides disturbing evidence the University of Delaware misled the courts in order to hide Biden's Senate papers. I'd say maybe lied to the courts. I guess misled is a nice way of saying lied. But that's what it is issue here. So we'll see what the Supreme Court does. Are they going to let the University of Delaware get away with lying to the courts and lying to the people to protect Joe? That's what I love about Judicial Watch. We never give up. Well, we do sometimes if we lose. We can't go anywhere. I mean, in court, sometimes you have to give up because you don't have any more recourse. But in this case, there's a potential new avenue of recourse because we caught, it looks like, Delaware lying, the university, to the court about whether there was taxpayer money behind the handling of Biden's Senate records, and if that's the case, we should be able to access them under their FOIA. So this is just like a great instance of Judicial Watch just keeping on. And I have another great instance of it, too. Two great ones. So Lisa Monaco was, you know, talk about a deep stater. Well, she's more than a deep stater. She was a top appointee, worked in the DOJ for years, worked for Obama as one of his top counterterrorism national security people. Then she left, went to work for a big law firm here in D.C., was a CNN analyst. At one point, she was up for FBI director. That's how well connected she is. And now she's the number two official at the Justice Department, essentially running the Justice Department. It's like she's the Rod Rosenstein of the Justice Department under Garland. So very powerful and influential person. She helped run the operations and the Russia smears and abuses of Trump at the Obama White House. She's running it again under the Trump under the Biden administration, targeting Trump. And we had filed a FOIA lawsuit about the management of the Trump raid by the unprecedented raid of his home by the Biden administration. I guess it was 2 years ago now. Was it coming up on 3 years ago? When was the raid? 2022? So it's not even 2 years yet. And we had gotten these records from top officials of the National Security Division of the Justice Department discussing the political implications of former President Trump allowing CNN to use closed-circuit TV footage of the raid on his Mar-a-Lago home. Of course, they didn't really want that to happen because they didn't want people to see how they abused Trump, including an email exchange in which the principal deputy associate attorney general, principal deputy associate attorney general, Marshall Miller appears to forward information to Monaco's personal account. Let's show that email. Okay, I gotta get close. So B5, don't you love that big redaction, that big black redaction? B5 is deliberative process, meaning there are internal discussions here. So we're waiting to hear back from FBI headquarters on their recommended approach on this issue about CNN getting the CCTV footage from Trump World. And Marshall passes it along to Lisa Monaco's email. And B6 means there's a personal privacy issue. And it also means, because of the other context here, that it's not a governmental email, it's a personal email. Isn't that amazing? So we uncovered that in our FOIA lawsuit. And now we followed up by asking, give us email. She's running a government, she's doing government business on her personal email account or accounts. We don't know. Give us the emails. They're government emails. Process them under FOIA. How many are there? In fact, we actually asked for this almost a year ago in June of 2023. All work-related emails sent to and from Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco using non-governmental email accounts from January 2021. She began the beginning, right, of Biden's presidency to June of 2023. So this is like Hillary all over again. Now, in theory, the records could, I didn't check DOJ regulations on this. I mean, my general impression is you are technically allowed sometimes to use your personal email for government business. Obviously, classified information, you can't do that. It's not secure enough. But there could be possibility where it just happens. But you're supposed to avoid it. And if it is a government business on your email, you're supposed to save it under FOIA and under, in my view, you're supposed to save it. I guess there could be legal disputes and ensure that it's preserved as a government record, which is why you're supposed to use your government email to do government business, because they've got internal processes to save all their email communications as such, as government records subject to FOIA. And the problem when they use outside email accounts to to conduct government business, you're not assured that's being done properly, and you just have to rely typically on the individual government official to follow the rules and ensure the records are saved. And in this case, the number two official at the Justice Department is using a government email to talk about their handling of the crisis caused by their improper, outrageous, unprecedented, abusive, knowingly violative of his civil rights raid of Trump's home. This is how I tweeted it out. You got to follow my Twitter. You got to follow Judicial Watch's Twitter. Everywhere. We're on social media all over the place, but I post some of the good stuff on Twitter. Judicial Watch uncovered how Lisa Monaco, the number two official in the Biden Justice Department, was using personal email accounts to help manage the DOJ's abuse of Trump. So we just sued for these emails for, as in further echoes of the Hillary Clinton email scandal, the Justice Department has been trying to cover all of this up. I already told you about her background. So this is an important email. This is an important lawsuit. Monaco is, I mean, I tell you, if Garland resigned, she might be Attorney General of the United States. I mean, she's that well connected and influential. And she was using private emails to conduct government business about the abuse of Trump. What else was she using it for? Of course, we have other lawsuits on the abuse of Trump. But this one goes beyond that in the sense that Monaco is the number two Justice Department official, and she can't manage to keep all of her business on government emails. Now, you know, I recognize, you know, back maybe 10 years ago or whatever, people might have mixed government and personal emails a little bit more than they do, you know, back then. You know, despite what the crazies say about Judicial Watch, is that we're really pretty reasonable. We understand how people work, and we understand how the government works, and we also, though, recognize that after 10 years, and especially after Hillary Clinton email scandal, I mean, what's the excuse for using government email to conduct private email to conduct government business anymore? There's really no excuse. And if it ever happens, it's supposed to be rare. And to me, the idea that we haven't gotten any records yet and they've ignored our FOIA requests suggests that it maybe isn't rare for Lisa Monaco, the number two official under the corrupt and compromised Merrick Garland. And everything you don't like about what Garland's doing is because Monaco's doing it for him. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. So this is an important new FOIA lawsuit by Judicial Watch. Boy, that was quite the hour or so, a little bit over the hour, I guess. But don't you love Judicial Watch, what we're doing? We've got all these great FOIA lawsuits. We're not even afraid to go after judges when they do the wrong thing. And we stand for the rule of law and try to protect our country, even in fights over in Congress where we can, as appropriate. Lawsuits in Delaware, lawsuits in Washington, D.C., taking on judges in Illinois, taking on top officials at the Justice Department, taking on politically connected individuals and Joe Biden up in Delaware. Nothing like Judicial Watch. There's nothing like Judicial Watch. And I encourage you to support our work. If you want to support our republic and you value the rule of law, I can think of few better ways to do so than by supporting Judicial Watch. With a donation, go to our Judicial Watch website, judicialwatch.org, and join our cause and join our movement. And with that, I hope you have a wonderful week, and I'll see you here next time on the Judicial Watch Weekly Update.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.